as if to mock his pretensions. Nancy sent this letter hoping I'd defend her reputation, but her husband is a Federalist, and is one First Lady to another. I'll let her sink if you wish. I smiled at Dolly giving me that title, a role she'd created herself, and I spoke from the heart. In truth, I seethe for her. Nancy has finally found a respectable place for herself, and John can't leave her in peace. Dolly watched me carefully.
So you take her side?
Whatever side John takes, I'm on the other. That made Dolly laugh. But then I added, no matter where I stand with Nancy, it'd be a disgrace to let that villain harry her to death. Dolly rose to stare out the parlor window to the gardens beyond. That does seem to be his aim. I hope he doesn't succeed. I'd relied altogether too much on hope. Papa's stubborn faith in the goodness of humanity seemed to bear itself out less and less every day. And after seeing all the ills in the world, I no longer merely hoped justice would come to the wicked. John Randolph is running in the upcoming election against my former brother-in-law, who would be far more helpful to your husband in Congress. John Randolph had miscalculated the damage ladies could do. We couldn't fight in the war, but reputations were won or lost on our fields of battle, and Dolly and I were prepared to set our cannons blasting. Tom wouldn't like my meddling in politics, would like even less my doing anything to help Jack Epps. But he might approve for the sake of his sister. I'd saved her once before, and he'd been grateful. I was desperate to win back his affections now, so I sat down with Dolly to write some letters to influential ladies, taking up Nancy's banner and blackening John Randolph's name. If we'd been men, he'd have called us out. Unfortunately, the only advantage afforded a woman in Virginia was that we couldn't be challenged to a duel.
Soldiers!
The cry came from Sally's 13-year-old daughter, Harriet, who came running in with her dark auburn hair streaming behind her, marshaling my younger children into the house. For a moment, I saw my sister in her. It was Polly that I saw in fright, and my heart stopped. But Dolly had the presence of mind to ask,
"Redcoats?"
"All soldiers, I think,"
the girl said. We crowded onto the portico steps, watching a ragtag group of boys marching up our mountain wreathed in gray mist. Even from a distance, they looked dirty, lean, half-starved. Some used their muskets like canes. One towered over his compatriots, and I caught a glimpse of auburn hair.
"Jeff!"
I cried, wilting with relief. "It's my boy." He broke away from the company, raced up the drive, and clomped up the stairs. He spoke in a rush as he swept me into his arms.
"The British went north. We never saw a redcoat."
That meant the British never met my husband's regiment, and the man in my life was safe. The British might have attacked Richmond and won, but instead they chose Baltimore, where Fort McHenry withstood a bombardment of more than 24 hours, leaving our flag, as immortalized by Francis Scott Key, still there.
"Where's your father?"
I asked, overjoyed by the news. Jeff only shrugged. I learned later that my son and husband had quarreled so violently that Jeff was nearly brought up on charges. My son wouldn't say why, but the details didn't seem important if the peace was won. By February of 1815, everyone was giddy. Southern gentlemen swaggered about, confidence restored, honor defended, reputations built, as a new generation of Americans defeated the British once again. Some called it a second American Revolution.
"Get on your best dress, Mother,"
Jeff said, his spirits high since returning home.
"I'm taking you and Anne to visit my lady love."
With his father's looks and his grandfather's charm, Jeff caught the eyes of beautiful women. But I'd heard the name of the governor's daughter bandied about more than once. And now that the war was at its end, Jeff was eager to see her. I was just as eager to lay eyes on the girl, so I dug through my closet. Homespun wasn't in fashion anymore, but we hadn't had occasion to buy anything new, so Anne and I donned our decade-old dresses from when we played hostess at the president's table. Mine fit without alteration. But motherhood and marriage to a drunk had made my daughter so thin that her dress positively swallowed her up. "I'll take it in," Sally said, going for her thread and needle. And when she was finished, we went off to meet the girl my son wanted to marry. Jeff rode ahead on horseback, while Anne and I followed in the carriage, a blanket on our laps to guard against the cold. When we arrived at Mount Warren, Jane Nicholas bid us welcome. I was surprised to find her quite plain, but she had a warm smile. Her mother, however, did nothing but scowl, apparently flummoxed to see us. As was the custom, Jeff went off to call on the gentlemen, whereas we were left to socialize over tea. And though Mount Warren was a prosperous house, we were offered only tea. At some point during the surprisingly stiff and chilly conversation, I urged Jane and her mother to call upon us at Monticello, and Mrs. Nicholas asked, "Why ever would we do that?" Sure that I'd heard her wrong, I only sipped at my tea, but Anne flushed to the tips of her ears. The rude mistress of the plantation eyed me squarely and said, "My people were merchants. Merchants know that wealth is money. But planters prize land, no matter how useless. And I pray that none of my daughters would bury themselves in Virginia, married to boys who have nothing but an old name and a patch of dirt." Jane cried, "Mama!" Refusing to reveal my own shock, I patted the girl's hand. "Don't be upset, dear. Your mother is only speaking her mind, as we're free to do in the glorious nation my father helped to build." Mortified, Jane rose, dragging her mother from the room. "Please excuse us. We must find some biscuits to go with our tea." Anne fanned herself furiously against the stifling heat of the fire. "Why, I never..." From the entryway beyond, where Mrs. Nicholas argued with her daughter, I heard her call me a very vulgar-looking woman. I seethed when I heard her say Anne was a poor stick, and I burned to hear her ask, "Don't you find it strange that Jeff Randolph, who owns nothing but a small tract of land and 5 Negroes, thinks he's ready for a wife? Of all the pretty girls who pant after him, you think he'd choose you?" Having heard quite enough, I said, "Come along, Anne." We didn't wait for Jeff. While Jane and her mother argued, my daughter and I simply climbed into the carriage and rode off. All the while, Anne kept saying, "I never. They think they're too good for us. They think Jeff's after her money." If a girl may be judged by her mother, Jeff is better off without her. We were still carrying on this way when we reached the top of my father's mountain, and someone wrenched open the carriage door. Anne shrieked in surprise to see that it was her husband, drunker than usual. And though the air was chilly, his face ran with sweat as he hauled her out.
"Where were you?"
Charles demanded. Wide-eyed, Anne stammered,
We went to meet Jeff's girl. I told you,
Are you going to lie to me?
He threw her to the cold, hard ground.
Go on, lie to me.
Charles, I cried, scrambling out of the carriage. But I wasn't fast enough to stop him. He kicked her. He kicked my delicate daughter in the ribs. And when she tried to rise up, he kicked her in the face, sending a spray of blood from her mouth.
You lying little bitch!
People would say he had a right to do it. He had a right by law. But I was her mother, and there were other laws than the ones made by men. Seeing my baby girl's bloody mouth, I reached for the coachman's horsewhip and lashed at Charles. The whip caught him on the side of the face, where he was still scarred from the blow my husband had given him with a fire iron. And Bankhead seemed so shocked to see that this time I was the one to lay open a stripe of blood on his cheek, that he stood like a stunned ox. "Run, Anne," I cried, ducking a swing of his arm. I wasn't afraid for myself. It wasn't me he wanted to hurt. So I grabbed hold of him, making myself a dead weight. I might be a vulgar-looking woman, but I was sturdy and my rampaging son-in-law couldn't easily throw me off. We grappled while Anne staggered to her feet, and while Burwell and Beverly Hemmings went running to fetch the overseer. "You leave her alone, Charles," I said, gripping his shirt tight. "You're mad with drink."
"You may rule your husband,"
Charles snarled, "but Anne's my wife, and I'm going to beat her until she remembers it." With that, he tore himself from my grip, leaving a patch of his shirt in my hand, then took off after Anne at a run. Monticello was in an uproar. Servants shouting, Bankhead kicking everything and everyone in his way. Chickens went squawking, dogs yelped and growled. And after a few moments, Sally rushed out of the house to help me up from the ground, whispering, "Charles passed her by. She's hiding in a potato hole." The thought of my daughter, my first baby, hiding in the dirt from her husband, made me wish that I'd let Tom kill him. As she helped me to my feet, Sally's long-ago words about the importance of the man a woman winds up with had never rung more true, because Anne was trapped with a cruel drunkard, and there wasn't a thing that we could do. Sally was my father's mistress, not the mistress of the plantation, and yet it felt right to have her at my side. The drunken brute's shouts echoed from the house, and Sally and I took the stairs two at a time in the vain hope of getting to him before he got to my father. Meanwhile, Jeff's horse came galloping up the road in a cloud of dust.
"What the devil is going on?"
We didn't stop to answer, but burst into the house where the madman screamed,
"Show yourself, Anne!"
Jeff was on our heels, gripping his horse whip. One look at his frothing, bloodied brother-in-law, and no one had to tell him what had happened. And my son went white to the tip of his nose.
"Did you do something to my sister, you rabid dog?"
Jeff asked, advancing on Bankhead.
"Someone ought to put you down. I think that someone is gonna be me."
Those were words that started duels. Words that demanded satisfaction. But Bankhead was so drunk, I'm not sure he heard. Instead, he was transfixed by the sight of my father, who emerged from his rooms in stern disapproval.
"Enough," Papa said,
very quietly, very severely.
"We value domestic tranquility here. Charles, I must ask you to reside under your father's roof for a time, not mine."
At my father's quiet show of thoroughly presidential authority, Bankhead seemed to suddenly shake free of his madness, and he sank to his knees and wept. Bankhead was being banished, and he knew it. He begged my father 1,000 pardons, sobbing that he'd tried to stop drinking but never was able to, that it was something in him like a demon. I didn't care. I fetched Anne, took her upstairs, bandaged her ribs and cleaned up her mouth and jaw, which were bruised and swollen. Then I put her in my bed, dosing her with some laudanum so she could rest. Bolting the door, I leaned back upon it like a guard. That's when Jeff came up the narrow stairway with murder in his eyes. "You keep away from Bankhead," I said, keeping my voice low in case children might be eavesdropping from the nearby nursery or their bedrooms on the third floor. "And when your father returns, don't tell him what happened here today."
"Why not? Cracking that monster's skull is the finest thing my father ever did. Too bad he'd botched the job like always."
"Stop saying things like that, Jeff. Disrespect from a boy is one thing, but you're a man now." He nodded grimly and leaned back on the door next to me.
"Then you won't object to my taking Jane for a wife?"
"I think you'd rather marry someone who'll bring no more strife into this family."
"Jane isn't her mother,"
Jeff said, reasonably, staring at his feet.
"I'm set on Jane. She's the prudent choice."
I stared, remembering my own seemingly prudent choice. "Oh, Jeff, be careful."
"I know what I'm about. My future prospects from my father I consider as blank. From my grandfather, not very cheering."
That my husband's fortunes were negligible, I knew. But since Papa retired from the presidency, Monticello had never seemed more fruitful or alive.
"Why would you say that?"
Jeff crossed his freckled arms.
"I've seen Grandfather's books. Monticello is large but unprofitable, and unless judiciously managed, will probably consume itself."
My father was a sunny optimist, and I was neither entitled nor desirous to know the extent of his debts. But my son was pragmatic and clear-headed, and I believed him. "Even so, marrying a woman you don't love..."
"You won't tell my sisters to marry for love. You want to, but you won't. You don't want them to end up at the mercy of a penniless drunk like Bankhead. It'll be a miracle if they find husbands with their promised 30 cents per annum. Though, with Ellen's caustic tongue, no amount would be enough."
"Don't be sarcastic," I said, reaching for his hand. Our shoulders touched in the doorway.
"My brothers are still boys," he said. "I'm going to have to provide for all of them, my sisters and brothers. So I can't marry anybody but a rich woman, and Jane's sweet. If I can make myself love her, you can do the same."
I glanced up at him, shamed that he should have such burdens. But I'd raised a man who could be relied upon, and that filled me with pride. So I never uttered another word against Jane, not realizing that she'd cost us everything. The next morning, I rocked my grandbaby in his cradle as Anne continued to sleep fitfully in the nearby bed. The movement of the rocking was a comfort when so little else was. Everything seemed in a turmoil. Anne awoke on a gasp.
"Where's Charles? I have to go to him," she said, her words slurred because of the swelling around her mouth.
"He must have kicked the senses out of you if you're even considering going with him," I said, my heart hurting that this was the reality of my daughter's life. She struggled to sit up against the pillows.
"Where else can I go?"
"You needn't go anywhere,"
Papa replied from the doorway, surprising us both, for he so seldom mounted the steep stairs that the crowded upper floors in which my family lived must have seemed to him like another world completely. Papa crossed the room and rested an age-spotted hand on her shoulder.
"You're always welcome here at Monticello, dearest Anne."
Bravely wiping away the tears that flowed down her bruised face, Anne said,
"But my place is with Charles. By law, he can take the children. You know he can."
"He'll soften, fearing the loss of you," Papa said. "His family will talk sense to him."
All his life, I think my father believed in principle that a woman belonged to her husband. But now he tried every way possible to encourage Anne's separation from Charles. Every way but telling her she had a right to do it. Maybe that would have made the difference.
"It was my fault," Anne insisted. "He worries when he can't find me."
My heart sank to my stomach, where it weighed like a stone when later that day Anne rode off with Charles, their children, and belongings.
"Patsy, I had to send him away,"
Papa said from where we stood upon the south terrace, overlooking the garden, the vineyards, and the breathtakingly broad vista beyond.
"I know,"
was my truthful reply. Papa squinted up at the clouds.
"Dr. Bankhead will have more authority to deal with his son, and if I let Charles stay here and Tom found out..."
I knew exactly what Tom would do if he found out that Bankhead beat our daughter. And I didn't know if I should be sorry or grateful that Tom was still too furious with me to come home.
Rounding his shoulders, Papa said, "In the meantime, I've sold my library to Congress to replace the one burned by the British. I'll use the profit to secure property for Anne alone, to make her independent if the worst should come to pass."
"Oh, Papa," I said, pressing a grateful kiss against his aging shoulder. It was startlingly generous, and also startling because my father had never encouraged independence in any woman before.
"I'll save some for Ellen, who'll need to attract a husband of her own soon."
"Given the fate of her sister, I almost wish Ellen would never marry," I said. "I deny loving any of my children more than the others, but you take more pleasure in some." Anne, Jeff, and Ellen were the children I knew best, and to whom I'd formed the first tender attachments. Even amongst those three, Ellen was special.
"She feels things too acutely for her own happiness. She's like her father, but without his temper, and such people aren't well suited for this selfish world."
My father smiled because Ellen was his favorite, too.
"She's the jewel of my soul. But we mustn't be too selfish. We must allow her into society and hope she finds a perfect love."
"Perfect love?" Ellen asked, swishing her skirts as she came up behind us, not even pretending she hadn't eavesdropped.
"Anne loves Charles, and look how that's turned out. There may be no such thing as perfect love."
My father smiled.
"There will be for you, pretty girl."
Dark-haired, slow-eyed Ellen wasn't as pretty as Anne, but at the age of 19, Ellen was slender and dashing, with supreme confidence. And she used it now to distract us from the sadness of Anne's departure.
"I recently met a handsome gentleman who was so perfectly the victim of ennui that it destroyed every attraction I might have felt for him. Truly, I'd bore you to list the suitors I became completely disgusted with visiting Richmond. I'd just as soon become a spinster and devote myself to the care of my beloved grandpapa."
She was teasing, I hoped. But the marriage prospects of our daughters were very much on my husband's mind when he finally returned for Jeff's wedding to Jane, with the first hints of spring. Tom had never been a cheerful man, but he returned to me a dour one. He now styled himself Colonel Randolph, and it relieved me that though he'd taken his father's title and demeanor, he wasn't unfeeling toward his children. When he crawled into our bed after having been gone so long, he said,
"Now that our son has taken a bride, it's time to think about the girls. Mrs. Madison extended an invitation to have Ellen in Washington City. She'll find a higher caliber of gentleman to court her there."
Quietly, I gasped at the expense this would entail. Ellen couldn't properly go to the capital without new dresses, new shawls, bonnets, and triflings of every sort. She'd be advised by Dolly, whose expensive tastes we could scarcely afford. But when I confessed my worries, Tom exploded in temper.
"What sort of man do you take me for? You think I'd help marry my sisters off, but will deprive my own daughter of the few dresses and combs she needs to secure her happiness?"
Lowering my eyes, I said, "I know you'd never deny your daughters a thing if it were within your power. I'm only worried for the expense."
"Did your father spare any expense for your coming out in Paris?"
Tom asked, staring hard.
"I've heard the stories. So many balls you had to limit yourself to not more than 3 a week. Stories your daughters have heard, too."
With that single astute observation, Tom leveled me. I'd so often entertained my children with stories about my days in Paris that any one of the older girls could have named my friends at the convent and recounted their exploits. To buoy spirits in hard times, I'd fed my girls a steady diet of opulent tales. How could I deny my vivacious Ellen the opportunities I'd enjoyed? "You're right, of course. I beg your pardon."
"It's not your place to worry about expenses,"
Tom ranted in a fever of anger that had been brewing since I'd meddled in his military career.
"That's always been the trouble with you, Martha. You don't know your place."
He then proceeded to show me my place, by roughly tugging my nightclothes and pinning me to the bed. I made no attempt to refuse him. I didn't dare. And in truth, I hoped that our coming together, even in anger, might mend the wounds. After all, Tom's ardent kisses usually broke through my reserve, and his release usually unraveled the knots inside him. But on that night, not even pleasure could untangle the trouble between us. In the dark, I whispered, "Tom, I offer my sincerest apologies. I know I've hurt you and offended your sense of honor. But please know that what I did, I only did for fear of losing you. I erred in love." To that, he had no reply whatsoever.
Chapter 34. Poplar Forest, 3 December, 1816. From Thomas Jefferson to Martha Jefferson Randolph.
"We've been weather-bound at this place. Johnny Hemmings and company will set off on Thursday. Our only discomfort is not being with you. The girls have borne it wonderfully. They've been very close students, and I'm never without enough to do to protect me from ennui."
My father knew I'd go through his letters once he was dead. This letter is proof that he meant to spare me from having to burn more than I already have. The company my father mentions in reference to their Uncle Johnny was Sally's sons, Beverly, Esten, and Madison. They were almost always with Papa in those days, engaged in a grand project to build a new octagonal house at Poplar Forest, where we once hid from the British. My father fled there now for the same reason, to escape Monticello, which had become, in some respects, a glorified museum and inn. Though it was a great expense, my father wouldn't deny his hospitality to visitors,
It seemed to him somehow undemocratic, or, at the very least, un-Virginian. Strangers stopped without even a letter of introduction, expecting supper and a bed. Most of all, they desired to lay eyes on the former president, the sage of Monticello, and, of course, to satisfy their curiosity about Dusky Sally. Under that scrutiny, Papa increasingly withdrew to Poplar Forest, where he could make plans for his new university and enjoy the sun Sally had given him. But he never wrote their names down in any letter. He knew better, and so did I. Perhaps my father also absented himself to give Tom the illusion of being in command, hoping it might ease the strain on our marriage. And I made myself as obedient and accommodating as possible, even though Tom had scarcely a tender word for me. I missed the husband I'd known, temperamental and morose, but fiercely loving, and I despaired of having lost that love, possibly forever. Meanwhile, from Washington came a steady report on Ellen's beaux. Mr. DeRoth was an insignificant little creature. Mr. Hughes was a man of no family or connections. Mr. Forney was aloof. Mr. Logan was not at all clever. Though my daughter had success pricing the scientific dialogues for her grandfather's library, she made no progress in finding a husband, and I couldn't find it within myself to encourage her to try harder, given how miserable my own marriage had become. I tried to count myself content that the love Tom once lavished upon me he now gave to our daughters, but it left me lonely even in a crowded house. I missed Anne unbearably, and worried every day what her husband might do to her. As for Ellen, I wanted her to come home straight away from her husband-hunting trip, but Papa sent her the profit from his tobacco so she could visit Baltimore and then Philadelphia, which put me in a near-depressive state until she returned to regale us with tales of her adventure. "Everything's so cheap and good in Philadelphia, and the people were most hospitable. Mr. Short came to see me, too," Ellen said, working her polishing cloth over one of the silver goblets Papa bought our last summer in Paris. Nearly the whole of Papa's silver inventory lay spread out before us on a dining-room table, and I looked up from the silver tumbler I'd been polishing. One from a set of eight that Papa had commissioned a silversmith to make per his own design. It must have been because Tom and I were so unhappy that I felt wistful to hear William's name again, and surprised, too, that William had visited my daughter. Papa had, indeed, given William an appointment that sent him to France and then Russia. But when Mr. Madison became president, he brought about an abrupt end to William's diplomatic career. For spite, I suppose. No matter the cause, William's return from Europe had been unheralded and shrouded in mystery. I only knew that he'd settled in Philadelphia, without his duchess, and I was painfully curious to know more. "Mr. Short called upon you?" I asked, setting the tumbler aside. "Twice, actually," Ellen replied. "He took me to see the house you lived in with Mrs. Hopkinson when you were a little girl. It's now occupied by tradespeople and has nothing to distinguish it. But I gazed on it with mixed feelings of pleasure and melancholy." I, too, had mixed feelings of pleasure and melancholy to think of the man I once loved squiring my daughter about Philadelphia, walking cobblestone streets I once walked, and telling her stories from my youth. Ellen continued. "We also visited the spot where my grandfather lived as Secretary of State, and I strained my eyes to get a distant view of his lodgings while Vice President. I was gratified by the sight of these now humble buildings, which recall those in whom my fondest affections are placed."
The swell of my heart made it ache. William had done more than watch over my daughter. He'd taken her places that recalled me and my father, places I was sure I'd never see again. But William gave these memories to my daughter, and it moved me beyond words to think he was still, after all these years, doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. Ellen would do well to find a man like him in the northern states, where everything was so cheap and so good. I'd never say it out loud, certainly never in my father's presence. But like Mrs. Nicholas, I, too, now prayed that none of my daughters would bury themselves in Virginia.
"Why does Ellen have all the fun?"
Jenny asked at my old harpsichord. She'd been playing song after song to entertain our company, and once our guests had retired, leaving only family and near relations, she complained,
"First her travels, now Grandpapa intends to take her to Poplar Forest. Not just Ellen, but Cornelia, too."
My father gave an indulgent chuckle.
"Oh, it's a very monastic sort of existence at Poplar Forest. Ellen and Cornelia are the severest students. In daytime, they never leave their room but to come to meals. About twilight of the evening, we go out with the owls and bats and take our evening exercise. You wouldn't enjoy it."
Jeff added,
"There'll be better bachelors at the governor's mansion than amongst owls and bats at Poplar Forest. I've asked Governor Nicholas to host a party for you girls to come out into society in Richmond next winter, when the legislature is in session."
There were advantages, it seemed, in his having married the governor's daughter. But I worried that Jeff arranged this for his sisters without asking Tom. Hoping to stave off an argument, that night as I got ready for bed, brushing my hair out in front of the mirror over my marbled dresser, I gently broached the subject with my husband. He surprised me by saying,
"The girls would like that."
I nodded, abandoning my brush to climb over Tom to get to my side of the alcove bed, a ritual that had once been flirtatious, but had now turned to annoyance. He stopped me, hands on my hips.
"What ails you, Martha?"
"What makes you think something ails me?" I was resolved to say nothing about my worries for the expense. My husband would tell me it wasn't my place. Even though his generosity, the dresses, the ribbons, the fripperies, would come out of pockets that were already empty. It wasn't my place to question him. My meddling is what had brought us to this unhappiness, so I bit my tongue. But Tom's eyes bored into mine in the candlelight.
"I suppose Jeff told you I intend to sell slaves to bolster the family finances, running off to his mother like he always does. He's still tied up in your apron strings."
I'm not certain how he could have surprised or appalled me more. When Tom proposed marriage, he said he was against slavery. Since then, of course, we'd quietly reconciled ourselves to the evil, convinced that the poor slaves needed us as children need parents. But selling slaves, how could we ever reconcile ourselves to that?
"Tell me you'd never do such a thing."
"I'm only selling one sullen girl,"
Tom answered.
"She's difficult to manage, but she could go for more than $500. It'll be an investment in the happiness of our daughters, and maybe the slave will be happier with a new master, too."
I rolled off him. Turning to the wall, a scream echoed in my mind. I'd held back my news as long as I could. But upon hearing the evil thing my husband planned, I was too upset to dissemble. "We're having another baby, Tom." I heard nothing but silence behind me. It had been 4 years since our last child, and we'd assumed my childbearing days were over. I'd been grateful for it. But now, at nearly 45 years of age, I was pregnant again and near tears to think it. I already had 10 children, far more than I had the strength to care for. Much as I loved them, I was wrung out with little ones climbing on me night and day. Giving birth to my last had weakened my health. God forgive me, I didn't want another baby. But children were a source of manly pride. So, given a moment or so, maybe Tom would find his composure and tell me how happy he was. Then I'd force a smile and tell him what a joy it'd be. Except it would all be a lie. All of it. So I turned and said, I don't know what to do about it. At these words, Tom eyed me with a mixture of curiosity and horror. Perhaps he was remembering my testimony, in which I claimed to have given his sister an abortifacient. I was remembering it, too. It seemed, at the moment, like an answer. We'd never stand trial for it. My father, if he knew, might not even object, for he'd commented almost admiringly on the practice amongst Indians. I'd hate myself, but I already hated myself for bringing another child into the world when we couldn't provide for the ones we already had. And yet, I should never have implied such a solution to Tom, not even as a desperate consideration that I'd talk myself out of, not even to get my husband's reassurances. Tom's lips thinned into a mean line.
There isn't anything to be done about it, Martha.
Chastened, I lowered my eyes and murmured what I believed to be the truth. It's likely to kill me this time. Then I turned back to the wall, where I lay trapped. During that pregnancy, I was so sick and swollen and sad all the time that I couldn't stand myself. The birth left me so insensible that I had to be told I'd given birth to a living babe. A fragile little boy, tiny and blue, for whom my father would eventually choose the name George Wythe Randolph. I was too weak to hold the baby or feed him, consumed with excruciating, debilitating pain and delirium. And though I was grateful to have lived through the ordeal, every time it seemed as if I might recover, I succumbed to a new cough or ailment. Scarcely able to sit up, I was confined to bed and bedpan, and Ellen moved into the room across from mine so that she could nurse me. In the months that followed, my daughters were forced to take turns at housekeeping in my stead, but the entire estate would have fallen to pieces if not for Sally Hemmings watching over my girls and instructing them where I couldn't. And I simply couldn't. Neither smallpox nor typhus had rendered me so ill. Not even fears for my father's reputation could get me out of bed. Not even to converse or dine with our guests. Papa's brilliant courtship with the public went on below stairs, but my world was suddenly and sharply confined to the warren of attic rooms at the top of the house. Oh, I saw and heard most everything, for Monticello was a noisy place, with creaky hinges and floorboards, and more than 20 family members in residence at any given time. My window overlooked the same expansive vista as my father's did, but my room was at a higher elevation. I saw more. I saw the reality. I saw, every day, Mulberry Row and all the little nail-shop boys who worked from sunup to sundown for our happiness, which only fueled my sickness and melancholy. One night, when Cornelia brought my supper up, she burst into tears.
"Oh, Mother, you're so very pale, and I'm such an unworthy daughter."
"Why would you say such a thing?" I offered my arms, and when she came to me, I removed her cap and stroked her dark hair. Cornelia cried,
How do you remember the numberless variety of orders and directions for the servants? I'm so tired of putting away the books and other things that seem to get everywhere all the time.
It becomes routine, I assured her, knowing she longed to trade the keys in the cookbooks for her drawing paper and pencils. You'll get better at it.
Father doesn't think so, she said,
wiping her eyes and reaching into her apron for a scrap of paper written in Tom's hand. I worried that he'd written a stern reprimand, but instead it was a poem about her housekeeping. Why frugal Miss Mary kept the stores of the house, not a rat could be seen, never heard was a mouse, not a crumb was let fall in kitchen or hall, for no one could spare one crumb from his slice, the rations were issued by measure so nice. But when spring arrived to soften the air, Cornelia succeeded to better the fare. Oh, the boys were so glad and the cooks were so sad. Now puddings and pies every day will be made, not once in a month just to keep up the trade. It was such gentle teasing from Tom, and so unusually good-humored, that I laughed. But Cornelia wept inconsolably until Tom came to comfort her, speaking soft words before sending her off. Tom closed the door and pulled a chair up beside our bed. Taking my hand in his, he said,
"Your hands are so cold."
"I'll feel better in the morning," I said, cheered by this unexpected husbandly affection.
"You've been saying that for some time."
He clasped my hand tighter and lowered his head.
"The physician says you won't survive another birth. And I've no intention of doing what my father did to my mother, or what Jack Epps did to your sister. It may be that we're better off sleeping apart."
Even as ill as I was, I didn't want to sleep apart from Tom. For 28 years we'd lain together, and as much as I'd come to resent him in my bed, it pained me more to think of him never there again. "Oh, Tom, can't we—" I trailed off, wondering what to suggest. I hadn't been willing to find an agreeable negress to sate my husband's needs when Dolly suggested it. That unwillingness had nearly cost me my life. But I heard from downstairs the violin of Beverly Hemmings, now 19 years old and a great favorite at Monticello, and it bolstered my resistance. Sally's oldest son had my father's freckles, his posture, and shared Papa's love of music, science, and hot air balloons. The time was coming, I knew, for Sally's son to be set free, and I dreaded explanations that would need to be made to friends, neighbors, and even my children. I'd found a way not to think of Sally's children as my siblings, not to think much of them at all beyond a bone-deep guilt and sadness, a guilt and sadness I never wanted my children to feel. That's why I hadn't taken Dolly's advice, and nothing had changed. So I never found a suggestion. Now Tom made one of his own.
"When Governor Nicholas vacates the office, I believe I'd be a good successor. I can be appointed to the post from the state legislature, and the governorship comes with a salary. Money that can't be lost to droughts or tobacco rot or Hessian flies. Money that's certain."
It was as close as my husband could come to admitting that the planter's way of life that had sustained generations of Virginians in wealth and luxury was a lifestyle in utter decay. My father's idealistic visions of an agrarian republic, where man's wealth could be measured in land, no longer reflected reality. At least, not all reality. Tom didn't need my permission, but he seemed to be asking for it.
"Richmond's not so far that I can't be at your side within a few hours' hard ride, but I'd have my own bed there, in my own house."
That might be the most important part, I thought. Tom would no longer be living under his father-in-law's roof. No longer a man whose position was uncertain. He might no longer be thought of as Thomas Jefferson's underachieving political and intellectual heir and dependent, but rather master of a mansion in Richmond and the entire state of Virginia. "Of course you'd be a good successor," I managed, as I debated the wisdom of an even greater distance between us. Given the long tension between us, how could I do anything but support him? Chapter 35. Monticello. 1st of January, 1819. From Thomas Jefferson to Francis Wales Epps.
A schoolmaster is necessary only to those who require compulsion to get their lesson.
I smile to read this letter, filled with stern advice for my sister's son on how to perfect his Greek grammar. Papa never seemed to believe that his own brilliance was unique to him. Instead, he believed his grandchildren all inherited his intellectual capacity, and that if they only applied themselves, they'd easily match his accomplishments in science, architecture, and statecraft. But he was always overly optimistic about the generations that came after him. Jeff was so burdened with his own growing family and managing my father's plantation that there'd never be any opportunity for him to become a man of letters, a thing for which he felt an acute lack. Perhaps one of my younger sons might attend the university my father was founding in Virginia, but until then, our hopes for the next generation of intellectuals rested upon Polly's son. My daughters, meanwhile, were likely to end up spinsters. Nothing came of their season in Richmond, during which the men allegedly considered them altogether too educated in the male arts and not enough in the womanly ones. In the end, only a single offer of marriage was made, and it was worse than none at all. The offer came from Nicholas Trist, a neighbor, the son of a friend, an idealistic but penniless boy of 17 who wanted to marry my penniless daughter Virginia of the same age. Though I'd married at 17, or maybe because I did, I thought them both too young to be entangled by an engagement that would decide the happiness or wretchedness of their lives. Inexplicably, the young suitor, who aspired to be a diplomat, addressed his request to me rather than to Tom, and so from my sick bed I composed a short note, entreating him to learn more of the world before judging whether Ginny was vital to his happiness. It'd buy time, I hoped, for my daughter to seek an older, more established man with whom to build an easier life, if such a thing could be had in Virginia, where the price of cotton had fallen nearly 25% in a single day. The irony wasn't lost on me that in warning away my daughter's suitor, I was doing exactly as my father had done to me and William. But I better understood my father's position now and felt a pang of sympathy. It was February before I was able to get out of bed and go below stairs, and the first full day I spent upright was on account of a special occasion. There was to be a reunion at Monticello, as we were expecting Anne and her reportedly now sober husband to dinner. So I summoned my girls down from the attic cuddy they had fashioned into a salon for themselves, where they were happier to contend with wasps and rafters than with Papa's guests. Then I had one of the servants carry down for me a comfortable but worn gilded chair from France to the kitchen, where I held my Le Cuisinier Royal cookbook open to my handwritten notes. Amidst the shiny copper pots and sooty walls of the kitchen, Ginny moped in like a kicked puppy, having apparently surmised that I'd thwarted her nascent courtship. Nicholas Trist would never have been so bold as to declare his feelings to her without my blessing, but I remembered the artful games William and I had played,
and knew such matters could be understood without being spoken. In any case, if Ginny was nursing a broken heart, she was too much a Jefferson and not enough a Randolph to say so. Instead, she sulked.
I don't see what the point of learning this is. A few months of housekeeping badly done aren't going to give me one useful acquirement, not even the industrious habits which would enable me to spend my future more profitably. I'd rather read than sew or keep house.
With a sharp look at her sister, Ellen said,
"Which will profit you not at all. Taking turns means we can each learn what we need to be useful wives, then go with Grandpapa to study like men do, for gratification and because it's the most agreeable way of passing time."
Then Ellen rounded on me.
"And, Mother, your insistence on supervising is defeating the purpose of giving you rest."
"I've been resting for nearly a year. I'm quite weary of rest," I complained, as the cook and the servants who did the arduous work here all bustled about.
"Besides, the less occupation we have, the less we're disposed to do."
That day, I rode the girls like an overseer, right up until the great clock reached the dinner hour according to the gong at the top of the house.
"Charles is coming along soon," Anne chirped, having arrived ahead of him. "He had to stop first in Charlottesville at the store."
My daughter Anne had turned into a scarecrow since I'd seen her last. She and the grandchildren lived poorly. Their threadbare clothes and worn shoes told the tale. And an hour later, Bankhead still hadn't arrived. Jeff was late, too. So late that Papa didn't want to hold supper any longer. Finally, at evening, the dogs barked at a rider galloping madly up our road. Burwell went for the door, but Ellen also raced for the entryway with unladylike haste. I tried to follow, but was such an invalid that the blood drained from my head. I nearly toppled Anne when she tried to steady me.
"Mother, careful. You're not well yet."
"It's only a visitor," Papa said.
But I never remembered anyone riding a horse that violently to deliver good news. And Ellen returned to the dining room, ashen, Overseer Bacon behind her, sweating and breathless from his ride.
"It's Jeff,"
Ellen cried, her eyes flitting with fury to her older sister.
"Your worthless, malignant husband stabbed our brother."
As my heart leapt into my throat, the napkin fell from my father's hand. Papa rose to his feet at once.
"Where?" "Charlottesville," Bacon answered. "They came to blows in the courthouse square. I had them carry your grandson inside Leitch's store and put him upon a bale of blankets. But he can't be moved. He's bleeding badly, and the physician doesn't expect him to live until morning."
Those words ringing in my head in all their horror, my legs went out from under me. The next moment I was on the floor staring up at the fireplace, where fickle fates carved in wedgewood danced in blue mockery before my eyes.
"Loosen her stays,"
Ellen insisted while my other daughters crowded around me, fanning my face. In my continued illness from childbirth, I'd swooned away like some delicate damsel when all I wanted was to get to my son.
"Jeff," I gasped.
Servants rushed in to help, and all the while I kept saying,
"Tom, please take me to Jeff."
But Tom wasn't there. My husband, the new governor of Virginia, now lived in Richmond, a thing I'd somehow forgotten in the fog of my terror.
"A carriage? Someone get me a carriage. I must go to my son."
"No, Martha."
The long-absent steely edge of fatherly command returned to Papa's voice.
"If Charles is on a drunken rampage again, he'll come here next for Anne."
"He can't have done this," Anne sobbed. "Charles isn't drinking anymore.
He wouldn't stab my brother for no reason.
He is drinking again, Mrs. Bankhead.
Bacon accepted a glass of water and chugged it down.
He literally rode his horse into a tavern. Your brother confronted him.